Blog Talk Radio.
According to a sympathetic Rothschild biography,
Belmont was actually dispatched to Cuba by Amschel Rothschild and his son, but took it upon himself to go to New York instead. He was even rumored to have been, to be an illegitimate Rothschild himself. Whatever the truth, Belmont was in daily correspondence with the Rothschilds and became their acknowledged representative in the United States. With no apparent capital of his own, Belmont soon was buying up government bonds, and within a few short years had created one of the largest banking firms in the nation, August Belmont & Company. Because of his known ties to the family, the firm has always been considered by conspiracy researchers as a Rothschild enterprise. At the outbreak of the Mexican War in 1846, it was Belmont who bought the greater portion of U.S. government bonds. Thanks to his aggressive business tactics, the Rothschilds soon had investments in American industry, banks, railroads, federal and state bonds, tobacco, cotton, and, of course, gold. Belmont was instrumental in later financing both North and South during the rebellion, which began in 1861. From 1853 to 1857, due in part to his substantial donations to the Democratic Party, Belmont represented the United States at The Hague, the seat of government for the Netherlands. He also insinuated himself into American society by marrying the daughter of the famous U.S. Naval Commodore, Commodore Matthew Perry, hero of the Mexican War and Tokyo Bay. An avid equestrian, Belmont introduced thoroughbred horse racing to the United States and served as president of the American Jockey Club. In 1849, Alphonse Rothschild traveled to New York to determine if the family should replace their agent Belmont with a permanent banking firm. Rothschild was impressed with the obvious opportunities in America and wrote to his brothers that a bank should be established, adding, "Without the slightest doubt, this is the cradle of a new civilization." Yet despite the obvious opportunities, the Rothschilds apparently made the mistake of not making a major investment in the United States, at least not openly. Had they established a bank in New York at this early stage in the nation's growth, there can be little doubt that the wealth derived from that one source would have dwarfed within a generation all that they had amassed so far in Europe. Wrote Rothschild biographer Derek Wilson, "It is difficult to understand why James and Lionel Rothschild ignored Alphonse's powerful advocacy." It was indeed difficult to understand from a straightforward business viewpoint, but the decision might make eminently good sense when seen from the conspiratorial view of history. First, there is the long-standing allegation that the Rothschilds, due to both anti-Semitism and suspicion of Europeans by Americans, decided to exercise their power through intermediaries such as Belmont, the Rockefellers and Morgans, and others. And there is now abundant evidence that the bankers of Europe were already conspiring to destroy the economically strong but politically fragile American Union. So, folks, Jim Mars stated it early on here. And, you know, I guess what bothers me so much in all my research over the years is to continually see the Rothschild influence and the banking influences, and how we have struggled as a nation against these mother bastard banks all of these years. And for that, you know, we have to say, you know, I credit Jim Jim Mars for putting this forward in his book, Rule by Secrecy. The American people have been targeted for centuries, two centuries, actually. And finally, they've been won over, you know. I mean, we are now slaves to these bastard bankers. And bankers. And the Occupy Wall Street concept is so real, so very real. But I've been struggling with this concept for quite some time now, since September, when they started. And as much as I support them, this nonviolent concept is so... it's so lame. You see these reports of these protesters being pepper sprayed and gassed and arrested and beaten and everything, and yet not violent, remaining not violent. And maybe it's against my sense of outrage. But God damn, revolution is not, maybe it started, can start through nonviolence, but it ends in violence. It always ends in violence. And, it's just not going to change. The world doesn't change that way. Unless you put down, unless you fight against these horrid people, against these corrupt bastards who own the military and own the finances and own you, all right? How are you going to fight against them non-violently? By sitting back and laying down and getting arrested? I mean, that's bullshit. The only way that you can fight these people is by fighting these people. Go against them. You have to go against their who they are. You have to fight them on the field, on the battlefields. This is how it's done. It's not going to be done, unfortunately, through some, waving a flower at some, assault guy, ready to shoot you with a rubber bullet or shoot you with a 50 caliber bullet. Like they're doing in Egypt, or I'm sorry, folks, but nonviolence is bullshit. It always has been bullshit. And the only way that you're going to ever, the only reason that these nonviolent movements ever took force was because there was always a threat of violence with it. In the civil, civil rights movement, you had people burning down Watts. You had black people. You had the Black Panthers. You had Malcolm X. You had people that were violently, insinuating what had to happen. You have to fight these bastards to get their rights. But you had Martin Luther King who was walking around, I have a dream, all right? But it's like bullshit. The dream was backed by millions of people fighting for their rights, people getting killed, people killing other people, this is revolution. We don't understand what revolution is, folks. We went through a revolution. We were founded on a revolution. And that revolution, believe me, was not founded peaceably. And it never is. This Occupy movement will turn violent. And it will turn. And it will turn. There is no question about it. And this government is very well aware of it. And the reason I say this is because they're already activating the FEMA concentration camps. They're already planning these major police movements and crackdowns on these protests. All right, they've already done it. They're already doing it. We don't know that these people are not being taken away. Nobody has reported on this. What's your name? Oh yeah, my name is bullshit. Who cares what your name is? The fact is who's the follow up? Where's the follow up? Where are you going? Where are you being held? Who, what's going to happen to a guy like this who gets, people who are beaten and violated, what's happening to them? Okay, and where are they going? And now Obama just signed this defense bill, okay, which allows you allows the United States to or the or law enforcement and the military to arrest and detain indefinitely American citizens, all right? What the hell is going on, people? I mean, the fact that we are sitting back like freaking assholes, okay, allowing this crap to happen and watching these people, these kids, these, you know, morons, if you will, okay, with nonviolent blah, 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 all right? I mean, this ain't going to work, folks. I'm sorry. It's not going to happen. The only thing that's going to happen is you pick up your Second Amendment rights. You take those people to the streets. You take millions and millions and millions of people to the streets. Occupy the government. Get in there. Kick those sons of bitches out and take over. That's the only way it's going to happen. The only other way, I mean, meanwhile, you got Republicans and Democrats, you know. You got assholes and asswipes, okay, sitting around, okay, debating whether or not to pull out of Iraq or Afghanistan one day. I mean, what the hell bullshit is this? What kind of crazy-ass government is this, all right? We don't need a government like this. We can't use a government like this. We never could use a government like this. And these are the roots of revolution. The American people were originated through revolution, violent revolution. Every revolution in this country and in this world and, you know, around the world has been a violent revolution. And, you know, that isn't going to stop. That will never stop. It's the nature. And there will be sacrifices. There will be people. There will be deaths. There have already been deaths. There will be people hurt. I mean, this is the way that it is. God love those people who will put their lives on the line. But where is our military? They're coming home. They're jobless. They're, you know, half of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress. They're cutting veterans' benefits. They're, you know, all of these things are happening, and these veterans have guns. They understand how to use weapons, and eventually they will be a part of this Occupy position because... An army of 100,000 men, armed, ready for action, could take over Washington, D.C. Could take it over easily. They could take over the Capitol building. They could take over the White House. They could hold the president hostage. These are the things that could actually happen. And believe me, folks, these are the things that will happen. I say this now. These things will happen. What we will get in the process, I do not know. But there are people like myself who are stating these things, and God knows what our repercussions will be. But every single revolution in this world has either begun non-violently and ended violently, and it will always end violently. They will start killing people, they will start killing protesters, they will start arresting them, they will start putting them in FEMA camps, all right? They will start putting them in concentration camps. There will be hundreds of thousands of people. And now, we have hundreds of thousands, we have millions, we have 50 million people in this country collecting food stamps because they cannot afford the basic, you know, food for their own, for themselves and their families. Shelter, clothing, these are the three essentials. food, shelter, and clothing. You can't. We have the richest country, supposedly, in the nation, in the world, and we can't provide for our own people. It's a tragedy, folks. And this is what revolutions are based on. This is why people revolt. When you talk about the bankers, oh, God, these thugs, these criminals, these bastards. You know, if you could destroy all banks, it would be a wonderful thing. Just destroy them. Who the hell needs them? Right? Got along fine without them before they existed. We'll get along fine without them after. That's concentrated within the Wall Street and within the banking communities, within these few, maybe 8 or 10 major banks, which involve the Federal Reserve. They control our lives. They control everything. Why are we sitting there in tents? Why are people sitting around in tents, it's a bullshit, okay? It's total madness, right? But this is what we're seeing today. People don't know how to strike back. People are eating genetically modified foods, drinking fluoridated water, smoking their brains out with pot and the coke and everything else that they're doing, right? Trying to obliterate, you know, the nightmare their lives are. You know, I know I've gotten probably off subject a bit here, but when I think every day, and I see this stuff every day, I do 4 nights a week here, and I write and I read. I have the most difficult time fathoming the mindset of the American people. Theodore Dreiser, a brilliant writer back in the turn of the century, in the 20th century, he wrote several books called Sister Carrie and Jenny Gephardt and 12 Men and so on. And his works were, considered the father of realism in the United States. But what he did in those books, which became, classics, which are classics to this day, was to describe the poverty of the American people at that time, to describe the split in classes, the upper class, the middle class, and the lower classes, how difficult it was to break into those classes. We're no different than the class structure in India, untouchables and whatnot. But there was no difference there. And he was a devout communist through his life, even though he's American and so on. But back in those days, communism was a very, very serious issue, taking hold in Russia and other countries. The Marxist concepts appealed to him because he saw the inequities. He saw the horrid inequities of his society, and he wrote about them, and he was able to get them published. But today, those inequities are here again. They're back. We've allowed them through Republican administrations. And I say this through Republican administrations, from the Reagan era right through up till now, and perpetrated by, you know, Bush and Bush Jr. and everybody else, have allowed our country to be taken over by the banksters, fraudsters, by the elite banking groups and corporations, to the point where we now live in a fascist state. Don't tell me we have freedoms. We do have, I can talk about this and so on and so forth. That doesn't mean it's not going to be censored. It doesn't mean that some guy listening to this is going to say, hey, blah, 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 write the blog doc and say, you know, get this bastard off the air because he's a revolutionist. I'm not a revolutionist. I'm just telling you what the hell the story is, pal. The story is, if you don't see it, you're an asshole. If you don't see it, you're an idiot. What Dreiser said, you're a potato. The majority of Americans are potatoes. Found couch potatoes today, but they're basically potato heads, you know. They have no brain, you know. They don't see it, and if they do see it, they ignore it, you know. And delve into a beer and a bag of potato chips, you know. It's like, I don't know, I have difficulty with this, but with this issue, and you can tell, but I think it's important to see how the bankers manipulated us and are manipulating us to this day, and how a revolution is so damned important and critical now in our society. War between the states. And again, if you came in this late, I'm reading from the Rule by Secrecy from Jim Morris. Arthur Epperson reported that an authorized biography of the Rothschilds mentioned a London meeting where the International Banking Syndicate decided to pit the American North against the South in a divide-and-conquer strategy. Such a plan would provide the solvent U.S. federal government with an enemy that would require massive war expenditures and subsequent debt. In the event of Southern independence, each state could withdraw from the Confederation, reestablish its sovereign nature, and set up its own central bank. Southern states could then have a series of European-controlled banks, the Bank of Georgia, the Bank of South Carolina, etc. And then any two could have a series of wars, such as in Europe for centuries, in a perpetual game of balance of powers politics. It would be a successful method of ensuring that large profits could be made on the loaning of money to the states involved, Epperson explained. Griffin quoted German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck as stating, "The division of the United States into federations of equal force was divided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained in one block and as one union, would attain economic and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over the world. The voice of the Rothschilds prevailed. Therefore, they sent their emissaries into the field to exploit the question of slavery and to open an abyss between the two sections of the Union. It is historical fact that for some years the Rothschilds had financed major projects in the United States on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. Nathan Rothschild, who owned a large Manchester textile plant, bought his cotton from Southern interest and financed the importation of Southern cotton prior to the war. At that time, wrote Rothschild biographer Wilson, he had made loans to various states of the Union and had been for a time the official European banker for the U.S. government and was a pledged supporter of the Bank of the United States. Europe's aristocracies had never been happy about the prodigious success of the Yankee democracy. If the nation now broke into halves, providing that democracy did not contain the stuff of survival, the rulers of Europe would be well pleased, noted historian Bruce Canton. lending support to the idea of Europe manipulation of the American situation. Another Rothschild biographer, Niall Ferguson, noted there is a substantial and unexplained gap in private Rothschild correspondence between 1854 and 1860, and that nearly all copies of outgoing letters from the London Rothschilds were destroyed at the orders of successors' senior partners. If this indeed was the gambit, presidential aspirant Abraham Lincoln saw it clearly. He often tried to explain that his goal was to save an American Union, not emancipate the slaves. And during his famous debates with Stephen Douglas in 1858, Lincoln made his personal position on race quite clear. "I will say, then, that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." And this was Lincoln. I mean, if Lincoln was Lincoln, you know, was a fucking racist. All right? But equally clear was Lincoln's determination to preserve the Federal Union. In late 1862, he proclaimed, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. If I could save it by freeing some..." "and leaving others alone, I would do that also." Lincoln understood that the true reason for sectional friction in the United States was not slavery, but economics. The South desired to buy cheaper imported European products, but the powerful Northern manufacturers imposed stiff import tariffs. These tariffs were quickly increased after Southern congressmen left Washington in 1861. Industrial North, filling rapidly with immigrants willing to work for pittance, had no need for slaves. And while the major planters of the agrarian South, were totally dependent on human labor, and although Southern leaders had continually demonstrated a willingness to compromise on the slavery issue, they felt that they could not suddenly abandon their peculiar institution. Anti-slavery advocates in both North and South realized that technological advances meant the demise of slavery was only a matter of time. But extremists on both sides, encouraged by agents of the European financiers, continually fanned the fires of discontent. The spearhead of this agitation came in the form of yet another secret society, the Knights of the Golden Circle, or the KGC. Secret Society Agitation. The secretive Knights organization was the creation of surgeon and author Dr. George W. L. Bickley, who in 1854 founded his first knightly castle in Cincinnati, Ohio, drawing heavily from local Freemasons. This society had close ties with secret societies in France called the Seasons, which itself was a branch of the Illuminati. Patterned after Masonic lodges, the Knights had similar passwords, handshakes, temples, and Grand Lesser and Supreme Councils. Initiates were sworn to secrecy with a live snake held over their head, accompanied by this blood-curdling oath: "Whoever dares our cause reveal shall test the strength of knightly steel, and when the torture proves too dull, we'll scrape the brains from out his skull and place a lamp within the shell to light his soul from here to hell." Yeah. I mean, these are nice guys here. These are your secret freaking societies that still operate in this country today, you know, and agitate and create these nightmare scenarios. Okay? These are the people. Oh man. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to explain this anymore. We are so manipulated. We are so freaking manipulated that we, you know, you can't even think straight. I mean, you don't even know how many influences are false and true and what's going on and why this is happening. But this is all planned and designed to be this way, all right? Designed to overwhelm an entire civilization, an entire society. These people have been planning this for hundreds of years. These bankers have been accumulating wealth and power, and their families have been accumulating this stuff. And these corporations, hundreds of years old, have just become, you know, implanted in as part of our society. And, you know, and they're killing us. They're enslaving us. They're depriving us of our freedoms and our liberties, and they are just the ultimate Satans. And yet we are out there playing up the Christian right and all this moral crapitude. That just unbelievable how we, you know, are so blindly deceived by this whole thing. 99.9% of the Christian right are satanic. In their views, satanic. They have no love for humanity. All right, they want to see humanity starve. They want to. I mean, Michelle Bachmann. You know, if you don't work, you starve. This is her. This is her statements. Okay. You know, Newt Gingrich. Okay, wants child labor reinstated in this country so that 11 and 12 year old kids can go clean toilets in high schools. And in their elementary schools. I mean, what kind of moronic, goddamn monstrous people exist here that we allow to be in our, you know, as that we even consider as leaders, or have any viable, viability at all? These people are fucking monsters. These people are criminal. These people are insane. You know, these are fucking insane. And yet you have people in Iowa. Where the hell is Iowa? I mean, who the hell cares about freaking Iowa? You know, Iowa is a goddamn state of about 500,000 people, all right? And yet they're the first to nominate the two party candidates. What the hell? Does anybody know anybody from Iowa? Does anybody even care to know anybody from Iowa? I don't, I never did, I never will, all right? So what the hell? What is the deal here? You know, I mean, if any state in the union should decide who the Republican and Democratic candidates should be California or New York. The two biggest states in the country. But no, you get the smallest state in the union, Iowa, all right, with a bunch of fucking Iowan corn pickers out there selecting the most important people that will run our country. What the hell is this kind of insanity? What kind of brain dead, stupid, you know, insanity is this as a political system? Makes absolutely no sense. Oh, excuse me, if you talk to an Iowan, it's very important. Yeah, well, fuck you, Iowa. What the hell? Okay, I mean, come on. Nobody lives in freaking Iowa, all right? So why should they be the first to select the candidates? Makes no sense to me. Makes none whatsoever. You know, God. I mean, this is the kind of insanity that we're dealing with here, all right? This is the kind of insanity that was brought upon this country, right? The Electoral College and the, you know, brain dead people. I mean, Iowa wasn't even considered even a state at the time of that. The colonies wasn't even thought about. Okay, and yet it has the in New Hampshire. Who the frick cares about New Hampshire? All right, why are these states so important? They're not. They're bullshit. Okay. Nobody lives in these states. I mean, they don't have a million people in either of these states. All right? So why do they get the privilege of being the first? makes no sense to me at all. Doesn't make any sense to most people, but yet we follow it because why? Because some asshole on the, you know, Chris Matthews or some other asshole, you know, says, oh, Iowa is important. Iowa, 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 you know. What a joke, you know. I can't deal with this much anymore because, you know, I may be bombastic, as the people love to say, but, you know, this is reality, folks. I mean, the reality is we live in a complete delusion, all right? This country has no clue what the hell it's doing. I mean, you realize, the number of people that watch American freaking Idol, vote for an American Idol, okay, on a singer, more people do that than will vote for the president of the United States. Why? Because they're all assholes. That's why. You know? You can't buy this stuff. And you can't believe this stuff. And the Knights of the Golden Circle were derived from Bickley's grandiose plan to create a huge slave-holding circular empire 2,400 miles in the circumference with Cuba as the center point. This new nation was to include the southern United States, Mexico, part of Central America, and the West Indies in order to gain a dominance over the world's supply of tobacco, rice, sugar, and coffee. While modern historians either ignore or downplay the significance of the KGC, or the Knights of the Golden Circle, okay, it is evident from the contrary writings, contemporary writings, and newspaper coverage that the organization was considered an extremely credible threat at the time, and Bickley has certainly a mysterious individual, always claiming to be in need of money, yet constantly traveling and entertaining dignitaries. The financial nucleus of his order was the American Colonialization and Steamship Company, organized in Veracruz, Mexico, and capitalized for $5 million. Somebody other than Bickley was paying the bills. I remember, $5 million back then, okay, was equal to about $5 billion today. He also had demonstrable ties to Great Britain, claiming to have been in 1842 graduate of the University of London. Early in the war, Bickley was the Confederate capital of Montgomery, Alabama, identifying himself as a correspondent for the London Times. And after the war, he lectured extensively in England. This guy was obviously a provocateur. He's obviously an agent, you know, for England. And for the Rothschilds. And Bickley appeared to have shifting allegiances and philosophies, kind of like Newt Gingrich. Previously, he had founded a society called the Wayne Circle of Brotherhood of the Union, which purported to seek constitutional unity. Just before the war started, and Bickley wrote an article for his Cincinnati paper, Scientific Artisan, in which he predicted the end of slavery, stating this institution is one altogether unenviable, as every reasonable man in America will at once admit. But despite the ideas put forth in his article, the first step in Bickley's plans for the Knights of the Golden Circle was to create a separate slave-holding southern nation, then move southward to Mexico, like the Nazis much later, and the KGC were concerned with the purity of blood, as demonstrated by his call for Anglo-Saxon blood from the Texasizing of the Mexican population. Now, here you got Newt Gingrich is a reincarnation of this guy, all right? I mean, you know, backtracking and, one day he's for this, next day he's for that, next day he's not, you know, the guy, you know, but he's also an agent. You know, the guy was a Jew who turned Catholic. Who the hell does that shit unless you paid for it? And Newt Gingrich will go anywhere he's paid for. He's paid to do it. Right, and you know, and then to go from a Catholic to, and then celebrated by the Opus Deus, the the freaking crazy bastards, elite of the Catholic Church. All right, so I mean, this is insane. You know, totally insane. But this is the kind of crap that people are. And it's the kind of crap that our leaders have become. You know? I don't know. I just get crazy. By 1860, there were more than 50,000 knights, mostly in Texas, awaiting orders to march on Mexico. Headquartered in San Antonio, Bickley gained popularity by pledging to kill Wall Street bankers, who he said were scheming against the South. He had a good idea there, didn't he? Kill all Wall Street bankers. This is according to Bickley. He also said that if Lincoln was elected president, Washington, not Mexico, would become the target of the Knights. In fact, there were two tentative invasions of Mexico in the spring of 1860, but both were repulsed by Bickley. After Bickley failed to provide his men with promised reinforcement and supplies. Texas heroes and Governor Sam Houston reportedly were a member of the Knights at the time, but resigned when the Knights turned their attention from the invasion of Mexico to the secessionist movement. It was in the cause of Southern secession that Bickley moved from successful. Bickley proved more successful as the KGC, Knights of the Golden, whatever the hell, Golden Circle, all right, came to form the nucleus of the Southern military. According to writer Oliver Crenshaw, the Southern press received the plans of the order with enthusiasm, and many newspapers became its exponents. The Vicksburg Sun said the Knights of the Golden Circle gave the South a military organization capable of defending her rights at home and abroad. The KGC was divided into three sections or degrees: the Foreign and Home Guard Militia, the Foreign and Home Guard Corps, and the foreign and the civilian support, and the American Legion. The American Legion. This was the political and governing arm. Reportedly, by 1860, membership in the KGC was more than 65,000 and constituted the brains of the South. But Bickley made their objectives clear when he declared, "The fact is, we want a fight, but how to get it is the question." Through constant agitation, the Knights stirred up hatred and fears throughout the North and South. After Abraham Lincoln was elected in 1860, this minority of the Southern minority, conspired to bring off a last gamble. In 1861, to the extremist amazement, disunion triumphed, and wrote historian William W. Freeling. KGC activity in northern states involved a plan to create a Northwest Confederacy composed of pro-Southerners in several states, including Ohio, Indiana, Montana, and Michigan. It's funny that these states are still the ones thinking of seceding, you know. And Illinois alone was reported to have a KGC membership of some 20,000. Now, if those of you know, Michigan militia was always a very strong issue up there. Minnesota, of course, has, you know, a number of people there, too. But the plan was to seize federal arsenals and then take control of the states and release all Confederate prisoners. One state official, Edmund Wright, tried to oppose the Knights, only to have his wife poisoned and his home burned. In August 1962, 60 KGC members out of a reported 15,000 members in Indiana were indicted for conspiracy and treason, but later released. Federal prosecutors were fearful of creating martyrs, and the conspiracy cases were weak. The Knights' actions created havoc with the national government, prompting President Lincoln to lament, "The enemy behind us is more dangerous to the country than the enemy before us." That's the same way we are today. The enemy behind us is more dangerous to this country than the enemy before us. And unfortunately, the enemy we're facing today is the Republican Party, Lincoln's party. You know, these kind of crazy bastards, all right, who want to cut our throats, you know, and starve the population. These heartless reptilian, you know, sons of bitches, right? The Lincoln administration was compelled to imprison more than 13,000 people on charges of disloyalty, which meant anything from speaking against the government to discouraging military enlistment. Those before the war had been called the loyal opposition found themselves after 1861 commonly referred to as traitors. Now, we're getting very, very close to that happening again. And I don't say that these people, maybe they were, maybe they weren't, I don't know. You know, disloyal or, you know, traitors. But we're in that position again. And Obama just signed the Pentagon and Military Act, which allows him to detain, allows military to detain American citizens indefinitely and imprison them, okay? You know, for any reason. Doesn't even tell you what reason. Then they call it terrorism, all right? Well, what's terrorism? What I'm saying here now? Okay, what these Occupy Wall Street people are doing, is that all terrorism? Well, according to this new law, it is, right? Talking against the government, talking, you know, bringing up conspiracy theories, bringing up freedom, just freedom of speech is now considered a terrorist act, okay, according to this new law that Obama has signed. You know? So we're here again. Now, Lincoln was a prick. No doubt about it, all right? But he had an issue. It was either, you know, are these people gonna break up the country, break up the union, break up, you know, what's going on, and why are they being, what's the cause? Who's behind them? Who's funding these people? Who's bringing this action, and what are they doing? I don't know. I mean, you know, that's the same thing that's happening today. Same thing. But the problem is the American people don't know, don't care, don't even understand what the hell's going on. All right? They don't even know who the hell the president is, the vice president is. They, you know, majority of Americans are goddamn stupid. And I'm sorry to say that, but they are. You just got to understand that. You know, believe it. Those of you who are listening to this program are one in a million, you know, people. One in a million. And, you know, I know that my words are spoken to one out of a million people each week, you know, around the world. I have people around the world listening to this program. But they understand. And they know. You know. You know what's going on. God, I know you feel the way I do. That you can't believe what's happening. You can't believe what people believe. And that's okay. Because, folks, the fact that we are here together, that I'm talking to you and you're listening to me and we're communicating, it says something, you know, and I'm not spouting bullshit here. I'm spouting reality. This is real. This stuff is real. Jim Mars did a tremendous job on this book, and I highly recommend that you get it. Ruled by Secrecy, Jim Mars. It's just a brilliant, brilliant, eye-opening book. And I got this 10 years ago, 11 years ago, actually, now. I got it in 2000 or 2001. And it opened my eyes to a whole entire world of what was actually happening. And to this day, I still am grateful to Jim Mars for opening that world for me. And there's so many are now entering a period of time that, you know, just, well, I don't know. I'll end with this statement, Jim's commentary, a couple of paragraphs. I still have a few minutes. There can be no argument regarding the reality of the secret societies today. The existence of groups like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, is well documented. The only question is the extent of their control and manipulation of major world events. Likewise, there is no question that members of these societies exert inordinate control over many of the largest corporations and banks in the world. These corporations in turn control essential minerals, energy, transportation, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, telecommunications, and entertainment. In other words, the basics of modern life. They also provide an inner core of ranking government officials on a revolving door basis. These officials often implement their very policies conceived and desired by the societies. These societies hold considerable sway over national elections and policy, yet they strangely immune to any investigation, whether by government or by the mass media. Since its inception in 1913, there has never been an outside objective audit of the Federal Reserve System, despite periodic calls for such. The same can be said for the powerful private foundations that direct so much of modern science and culture. With that, I say good night. I'll just continue with another few paragraphs you can catch in the archives. Taken together, the facts suggest that the overall goal of these modern societies is to bring about one world government with attendant centralized social control and loss of national sovereignty. This objective is coming ever closer to reality, largely through the increasing corporate and financial control over both government and economies. Samuel Berger, Clinton's national security advisor and a regular attendee of the Bilderberger meetings, revealed the group's outlook in the recent talks at the Brookings Institute when he stated, "Globalization, the process of accelerating economic, technological, cultural, and political integration is not a choice. It's a growing fact. It is a fact that will proceed inexorably with or without our approval. It is a fact that we ignore at our peril." And much more to what he states here, and I won't go into it, but the understanding the role of secret societies, understanding the loyalties that our leaders have to these demonic groups, explains the situation we're in today, explains how we got here and where we're headed unless we wake the hell up. Yeah. And I hope in some way I might have woken a few more people up tonight. If you like this show, I suggest please send it to somebody, please send it to a friend, send it out. And post it on Facebook, post it on Twitter, post it on, you know, wherever. You can email a friend, but have them wake up. God, Americans have to wake up and understand what's really happening to them. And with that wonderful thought, I'll close tonight. I ask that you join me tomorrow night when we have George Dixon, and we'll be discussing the 2012 timeline. Interesting aspect of February of this year, coming into February, where we expect to see a tremendous prophetic shift or changes. Could be physical, it could be mental, but or spiritual. However, there is going to be a major change taking place in February of this year throughout the world in its consciousness. And it could also interrupt, it could also be involved in solar activity, could involve seismic activity. We're not sure. But the Mayans predicted it, and boy, they've been right on all along. So we'll be discussing that issue and other things tomorrow. So please join us tomorrow night at 8 o'clock with George Dixon. And I thank you for joining us, and have a pleasant evening.